Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. It's not really the 100th, actually. It's like, what is it, Lee? Like 100 and...
124.
There was a time period when we had so much to podcast, so much to say, that we were doing two episodes a week. That was an amazing time, gentlemen. But today, we are going to revisit a movie from our past, The Deer Hunter. I'll let Jeremy explain how that went down. Then we're going to move on, and we're going to have a special celebrity guest. Well, he's a celebrity to us. Who's going to talk with us about the Marvel franchise and go into depth on Avengers Infinity War. And then we're going to wrap it all up with our top five movies of the 2010 decade.
Nick. This is the groom, Steve.
I'm the best man.
We're going airborne soon.
I hope they sent us where the bullets are flying.
That's right.
Fighting's the worst, huh?
That's right.
Bucket.
Bucket. What do you say? Bucket. That's what I did. Yeah. Well, what's it like over there? Can you tell us anything?
Bucket.
Here we are in the 100th episode, and we're going to talk about The Deer Hunter and our thoughts on it maybe 10, 12, 13 years after originally seeing it.
And appropriately celebrating its 40th anniversary of release, 1978, which I think is nice.
It is. You're welcome, The Deer Hunter.
Yeah. So I, you know, we try to, I think, when we ask these opening questions on the podcast, try to avoid, you know, saying, hey, did you like it or did you not? But I think, you know, in this case, I think we're dealing with something a little bit differently. But, you know, my thought was, you know, we're doing a revisit. That was some, you know, that's probably the word that came up more than any word ever in any of our podcasts dating all the way back. And we're always talking about movies we need to revisit. And the whole purpose of revisiting a movie is to kind of see whether or not it's a movie that we still like or we still feel the same way about. And so it sort of leads me to a pretty simple question for you guys in that, you know, is The Deer Hunter as good as you remember? Does it hold up? And you can answer this any number of ways. And, I I'm kind of curious almost to see what direction you guys go with it. But, like, you know, is this a movie that... upon watching, let's put it this way. In 2018, is The Deer Hunter a movie that you can appreciate and enjoy and like the same way you did when you first saw it?
Well, I think it's an interesting question because for us growing up when we did, going to film school when we did, The Deer Hunter is one of those movies that you watch pretty early on in your film education and it impacts you whatever way it does. You know it's important. You talk about when you watch it in film school, you talk about when it came out right after the Vietnam War, what was the impact on society. And then since then, it's sort of been in the back of our mind as being an important film that we have to have reverence for. And it's also been spoofed in pop culture since then. You see it on... Yeah. Comedies like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, you see it in Family Guy, and you can have a good laugh about it. And now that it's been a decade plus since at least I've seen it up until yesterday, that's sort of where it sits in my head as this, I know this movie's important. I know it had these performances from some of the great actors of that generation. You have De Niro, Christopher Walken, Meryl Streep. And it's an important movie.
The great John
Cazale. And it's an important movie in terms of when it came out to the Vietnam War. And that's what you're thinking about. And then when I rewatched it, I was just like, Jesus, this movie hits you in the gut. Like, we all know those famous scenes of the Russian roulette and you know, that's there. But like, those scenes are so fucking impactful. And you're watching this movie and it's just like, wow. Like, you see these guys who are friends and their wives and girlfriends, and you see them living in this amazingly like gritty small town that they capture perfectly, this mill town in Pennsylvania, and you see the relationships which aren't all perfect or a little fucked up sometimes. They're sometimes sleeping with their friends' girlfriends and wives and whatever it is, but there's this sort of authenticity that you see portrayed on that screen between men, really. And then they go off, they go to war, and you see the brutality of it in these very few scenes that are represented by this Russian roulette game. And it just, it hits you so hard. And I couldn't, like, I don't remember being as affected by it the first time I saw it. And since then, it's just become this iconic film that I know I'm supposed to like. But seeing it again, I was just sitting there kind of in awe of how well it breaks down those relationships and breaks down what it's like to go from pre-war to war in Vietnam. And I don't know, like, for me, it hit home really hard. It worked really hard, really well. I don't know. What did you guys think?
Japen?
Well, I kind of had the opposite reaction to you. I think that this movie has not aged as well for me. I do think it's an amazing movie in a lot of ways. I think that the opening hour and 10 minutes with the wedding and the preparation for the wedding, seeing the guys working in the steel mill, they are amazing. And you and such smart filmmaking, you get so invested in them. And there's so much sort of, you know, realism is obviously not exactly the right word, but there's so much sort of... you know, there's not a lot of structure to it, and you really just kind of are going along and spending this day with them.
Yeah, I think realism's right. I mean, it like just seems to paint this very vivid picture of a time and place that and you can't get anywhere else.
Go ahead.
The first act and the third act, I think, are really strong. But I think the problem I had with it this time was that middle act, that the Vietnam, and I think my problem with it was the Russian roulette. I think, you know, you've got, like, you think about the way he uses his screen time. This is a 3-hour movie, and you don't get to Vietnam for, you know, an hour and 10 minutes, and then once you get there, basically the sum of their experience is this, you know, awful Russian roulette game that they were forced to play. And look, I understand that there's like a metaphor here or something, but I mean, in reality, like in the movie, Russian roulette became the wartime experience for them. And it, not that this matters or anything, but this isn't based on there's no account of anybody playing Russian roulette for real. And like, and so I guess like my problem with the movie is I just felt like, I mean, initially the way the Deer Hunter began, it was based, I think, on a short story or something about, or a script about, you know, Russian roulette, people playing it in Vegas, and then it morphed into this Vietnam movie, and so you can kind of see why that happened, right? Like, but to me, you know, I don't know, it really was that aspect of it that did not that fazed me this time. And this is still a good movie. It's just that part of it just did not, just, I don't know, something about it didn't work. Hopefully, we'll work.
Well,
this
for
out,
me. But. Well, for me, it worked because, and I understood that this is not like a realistic depiction of stuff. It's just, it worked because it was like the filmmaker being able to boil down the intensity and the horrific nature of war to that quintessential scene and putting you in there with them. And that, to me, was like... their experience, it didn't have, like, it represented their experience in war to me, and it was able to communicate that to the audience really quickly and really effectively. And ever, like, when once they got back, you know what they went through. Well, yes, it happened to be that situation, but because it was so intense and it was something that you sort of sat there with them, you could then, again, in that third act, sort of live out what life is like having gone through such a traumatic thing.
Oh, I want to hear from you, Lee, but I mean, I just don't see how that experience is indicative of Vietnam at all. I think that they, you know,
I don't think it matters if it being indicative of Vietnam specifically. I think it's indicative of going through a traumatic event, aka war. It just happened to be Vietnam this time, but it was a way to represent that in a really quick amount of screen time and get it through to the audience of just how horrific it is to be going through some sort of event like this. And I think that was the idea behind it. It wasn't necessarily to say, hey, this is what Vietnam was really like. It was more about, hey, look, this is the intensity that you can go through during something like this, and then this is how you have to deal with it after.
So I'm glad that we have some differing opinions here, because I 100% agree with Jeremy. Like, I don't know if I could have said it better. Like, we were originally talking about doing our top five movies of all time. I can't be sure that this wouldn't have ended up on it. Like, the way I reacted to this movie was unreal. Like, I like this movie more than I pretended to like it when I was in film school. Like, it has nothing to do with whether this is a relatable or important or topical story about Vietnam or post-Vietnam. Like, this is a story about friendship and family and struggle and change and how to deal with change and how it affects people and the people around you. And I think, you know, everything from, like, the looks on the characters' faces, and I just thought this movie worked. The juxtaposition between the first act and the third act is perfect. And, you know, I think the wedding, which, you know, anytime you have a wedding scene that lasts as long as that does, it's going to be critiqued. And I think it's so perfect how you see how, as these characters get more and more drunk during that movie, they reveal kind of their true emotions and, you know, who they really are and what they're anxious about and, you know, how they're really feeling. And I think it's perfect. And you see, you learn so much about these characters in that first act. That the movie wouldn't work without it. And as long as it is the hour and 10 minutes, it wouldn't work without it. And, you know, I think, you know, the challenge that, you know, Chapin, you bring up is the Russian roulette and whether or not that works as the turning point. And the thing that I, you know, sort of immediately equated it to is the Mandingo fighting in Django. You know, whether or not that really happened or not, it's you have a visceral reaction to it, and you can kind of understand how that can affect a person. And I think that's what kind of is the catalyst for the rest of the movie. And honestly, like, I have more notes on this movie than I think I have on any movie that we've ever podcasted about. Like, there was so much I reacted to that I thought worked perfectly.
What did you guys think of the transitions between the acts? Like, that transition when they were from the first act to the second act, when he's playing piano and they all sort of have this, you can call it whatever you want, realization, just moment together. And then you hear the helicopters and you know you're going into Vietnam.
I thought that transition was great. I thought that once you get to Vietnam, it's a completely different movie. It's a ridiculous movie. Like, you've got all this great realism in that first part. You bond with them, and then you get there and he's like torching. He's like lying among he's lying among dead bodies, and then he torches a bunch.
But it's the horrors of war.
But it's
that's what it is. It's not
okay.
About...
So then fine. I guess that is. But it's. I mean, he's kind of a, like, I don't know.
So and I can kind of understand where you're going with this, Chapin. And the scene, the great thing about that scene right before war, when he's playing the piano, and it's the most powerful scene in the movie, I think, by far. And, you know, everything is nonstop up until that point. Everything is, you know, the deer hunt that they go on is a bit meditative. But aside from that, you know, everything is very... like quick, and you know the they get drunk at the wedding, and they're playing pool at the bar, and everything is quick, and then everything just kind of stops, and you see on their face like, okay, this is the end of this. Everything's going to change, and they know that. And I think where you, I think that the problem maybe you have with that first scene in Vietnam, Chapin, is kind of like the tonal shift that it takes is consistent with De Niro's character, which I actually had a little bit of a hard time with at the beginning, and almost thinking De Niro is too big for that role. And I think maybe that wasn't the case in 1978, but is now. But it's important that he's that big in the movie and that he is a warrior at war and he can pick up a flamethrower and torch some people. I think that's important to his character. And I think I think that's sticking with the consistency of who he is, and he's the only one that can fix everything in the end, if it can be fixed at all, when you get to those scenes. And then that plays, again, into the Russian roulette scenes. He's the one that comes up with the plan, and I think that's all, staying true to the character development.
Yeah, no, I think De Niro was amazing. I think he carried this movie with such bravado and grace in a weird way that you haven't seen from him and you forget he's capable of, and you haven't seen from him for years, but there was just something about him that was so stoic, and you knew he not necessarily had it all together, but he had some level of confidence that would carry him through, and it would carry him through those traumatic moments that you saw within Vietnam, and then also after the fact, to be able to try his best to try to piece things together. And you saw his flaws too, because as much as he cared for Christopher Walken's character Nikki, he still wanted to get with Meryl Streep's character, who was his girlfriend. I don't know, there was just a lot of complicated emotional things that were carrying around in his head, and you could see it on De Niro's face.
No, everything is on their face. There's no exposition in this movie. Yeah. Everything is on the characters' faces, and De Niro gets a lot of credit, and we will always credit Meryl Streep, and Christopher Walken won an Oscar, and we love John Cazale, but even these side characters, the guy who plays Axel and the guy who, now I'm forgetting his name, the bartender, the guy that owns the bar, these guys are all so helpless. These supporting roles, John Cazale and those two guys, they're so helpless. There's nothing they can do, but you understand, they're just good friends, and they want to do whatever they can, and that's all on their face. That is never revealed. They never say that. That's what I think works so well about this movie. It's a credit to the performances. It's a credit to the direction. I'm glad, Chapin, that you perhaps were not as high on the movie, because I think this would just be huge cinematic jerk off to The Deer Hunter otherwise. So
yeah, I think to compare this movie to other movies of its decade, is like The Godfather, and even Apocalypse Now is kind of ridiculous. I don't think this movie is that good. I think it's melodramatic. I think that verisimilitude, that realism of the 70s, that sort of style that I think Cimino kind of co-opts here and uses, at whenever he chooses, doesn't apply to his plot. His plot is the Russian roulette, all that is so extreme. It's kind of cheap to me. And
I can understand that. But I don't see it that way, but I can understand what you're saying.
I would understand if, let's say, and I'm not trying to rewrite the movie, but let's say he went back for Nick with Nick to get Nick, and he was doing the Russian roulette in the casino. And you're the assumption is that the Russian roulette is some way that the violence and the trauma of war has manifested itself, right? That would be, to me, that's an interesting idea, and that's what I kind of took away at the end there. If you're looking at the best scenario for that, it's okay, that's great. This is something real, but no, what is the meaning of that? It totally changes. That metaphor doesn't work. It totally changes the way that what it means at the end there, which I think is that's the culmination of the scene. Is he's there and he has to play him in Russian roulette. But But the idea now is that, so then you leave it thinking like, what is Nick like, is he addicted to this? Is he like, why he was so scared to play it before, but now he's been playing it for seven years and now he's only, and then he dies right when Robert De Niro comes back for him. I mean,
I think maybe there's a plot hole somewhere mixed in there, I guess.
Yeah. Right? In Nick's head.
Yeah. Right. But I don't know. For me, I don't think I ever got to the point where I had to think that hard about it. I agree with you to a certain extent about the melodrama in this movie. Like, I totally could have done without the God Bless America at the end, but I think that speaks perhaps more to where we are today in our country than where we were in 1978.
I took that ironically.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
No, I'm serious. I did. I thought it was ironic. I mean, it was supposed to be like, oh, look at all this fucked up thing. And
I don't think it was in 1978. I think maybe
hated the Vietnam War back then, especially filmmakers. And
yeah, but I don't know if that was supposed to be ironic. Well, regardless, I mean, I could have done without that scene. And then, like, you know, there were some moments that, you know, for a movie that has sort of a lot of metaphor in it, like, I totally could have done without the spilled drop of wine at the wedding that, you know, foreshadowing the rest of the movie. So in that element, I agree with you that this is a melodramatic movie, but...
And the score also does... It lends itself to melodrama.
That's true. But I think, you know, melodrama gets a bad rap. Like, I think, you know, you hear melodrama and you assume it's also going to be bad, where I think this movie plays that well. I think there's a reason to be melodramatic for these characters. And, you know, like, Meryl Streep is totally lost on how she should be feeling, you know, and especially in that third act. And, you know, so I think it's placed appropriately. You know, and I think, again, with the Russian roulette at the end, I think if you think too hard about it, maybe you start to question too much about why is Nick kind of, you know, in this kind of brain dead sort of state where he doesn't recognize Mike and he doesn't really know what's going on. And yeah, he's survived all this time and made all this money playing Russian roulette, and now he just happens to die this time. But I suppose that's just the risks of Russian roulette. But I don't know. I didn't think too hard about that. I think it just, the Russian roulette, I mean, I guess if you can't get past the Russian roulette scene in Vietnam, you're going to have a hard time with
but
this
it's,
movie.
It's but not that it's not that I can't get past it, but I guess what that means to the whole movie. The whole movie is like about Russian roulette at the end of the day. It's not about...
Well, no, I think it's just it's a metaphor.
It represents the war, and it's a way to put you as an audience member into...
And it's a way to do it quickly.
Really quickly into a horrific, horrific situation with him and his buddies.
Yeah, if anything, I think it's smart. Like, how, you know, Cimino may have looked at it and said, like, how am I supposed to get an audience that, you know, really has no understanding of what's going on in Vietnam to quickly understand the horrors of it and what people are going through?
But
and
I also think what was really smart of what he did was take the time before he got to Vietnam. And I also think it helps against
that's the best parts of the movie, yeah.
Melodramatic argument is that this movie takes its time with its scenes.
It concentrates
on the small, important
in
moments.
Those moments. And then he's like, oh, well, here's this giant hammer I'm going to lay on you by showing you this awful scene that has really no relevance in reality.
For sure, it's a giant... It doesn't matter if it has a relevance in reality, like we said. I don't think that was important to them, to the filmmakers at the time. But
you don't think that works? The giant hammer, like when you're pacing
things
so slowly and
then
the giant hammer
works.
Comes down, I think that's great. Yeah.
I think it does in a movie where you didn't spend the first hour and 10 minutes before this, you know, kind of fixated on these minute details about this life in this, you know, steel town.
But then we already know these characters. We know who they are. We took these people from this super realistic, gritty.
Exactly, in a very subtle way.
I love the location work in this,
by
the
way.
It's
amazing,
I think it's one of the best I've ever seen. And they take all that, and then they throw you immediately into this crazy, albeit crazy, but so what? How did any of those guys ever feel going from small town Pennsylvania, getting dropped off in a helicopter in Vietnam? I think that's what he's trying to get at as a director.
Yeah, I think the tonal shift works. Like, when you have massive tonal shifts like that, you know, they don't always work. But I think the tonal shift is the same for us as it is for those characters. Like, they're going from this small town Pennsylvania to this absolutely, like, absurd, like, dramatically crazy situation that I think that, you know, we go along with. Like, I think that's why it works.
Yeah.
You're wrong, Chapin, is what we're trying to...
Look, I admit it. And my, you know, when I was a younger, more aggressive, you know, late teen, early 20s...
Russian roulette player?
Yeah, I got into the extreme nature of this movie. But now, to me, I think, you know,
you hate that guy.
I mean, the effect of that, the effect of seeing that scene for the first time can't be lost, and I can't, you know, I can't overstate it enough here. But I guess what I noticed this time around was like the subtleties of, in particular, Meryl Streep, who I thought was a revelation in this. Like, she's so, her performance.
Let's compliment Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep, a revelation.
I mean, really? You don't think she was amazing in this movie?
No, she was.
Look who we're talking about. I mean,
she was. She seemed almost like she was in a bit of a different movie than everyone else.
Yeah, the movie I would have rather seen, to be honest with you. But like, I think there are moments where, and like, there's just like there are just very subtle moments. Again, before and after these, like that time, that moment when the doctor comes up and is like, "Are you Nikonar?" And like, you get the idea of you. Like little things like that scene, which was so great. Like, you understand like who these people are. Like, they're these Russian.
But that's them putting you back into what, like, the realities of war. Like, that's them taking the time when they're not in the battle to show what it's like.
I guess, as best they can. I mean,
you like those.
But this is
moments.
The thing is, so the first act of this movie and the third act of this movie are what makes this movie. They're the best parts of this movie. But I don't think that they would work with each other if not for the brief and, you know, extreme second act of this movie. And, you know, however he chose to do that with Russian roulette or whatever, you know, other alternatives there may have been, I don't think that they would have juxtaposed each other as well as they did without it. And I think that's why this movie works so well, as you see this world in Act One, and it creates such a perfect, you guys mentioned, it creates such a perfect time and place. Like, you guys might not even have noticed, there's this one shot at some point, I don't even remember, it doesn't matter, where you see this guy
one
like maybe
shot.
Yeah, one, yeah, perfect.
This is this, all right? This is this.
All right, Chapin, this isn't something else. There's a shot where, and I don't even remember where within the first act it was, but it's kind of a wide shot, establishing shot before a scene is introduced, of this guy that maybe he had a bottle in a bag with him, a drunk, just kind of standing there. And it just was such a perfect representation of the time and place that they were in this, like, Milltown, Pennsylvania. And like, when I saw it, and it just was sort of a revelation for me. I was like, this is where we are. Like, I'm there with them. And like, you get to the wedding and you just learn so much about them and what they, and who they are and what they're about. And, you know, and they're so excited and anxious to go to Vietnam and to feel like they're ready, and then you see the third act where so much has changed, and you
as an audience member in that third act, you kind of get put in these guys' position where you're seeing the regular citizens interact with them, and knowing, because of the intensity of that second act, and knowing what they went through, and knowing that there can never really be a conversation there.
Yeah, and I just think it works so much better than movies like and these are movies I like Coming Home and The Best Years of Our Lives, which I think are great movies. Like, I think this works so much better, and it's because I think you see that juxtaposition, and you know who they were before, and you still see a semblance of that. You know, that person is still there, but they have clearly changed. And I think you saw enough in that brief second act to understand it. And I guess it's hard. Like, if you don't see enough there, then you're not going to it's not going to totally work 100%. But
yeah,
for me, it did.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing I thought would be interesting for us to talk about moving on a little bit is that, you know, life in that first act, and I, you know, we've talked about why it's important that it be a good act, but you know, these guys are like really working class, maybe bordering on poor people who live in this kind of really shitty area of Pennsylvania and steel country, but life for them is actually pretty good. You know, it seems like it doesn't really seem that bad, but you'd make a movie like this now and the movie would be about those people and how hard their life is, you know, just living in that first act would be the whole movie, right? Like it wouldn't be. And I just think that's an interesting way to look at things, like how much at least the country has changed since then, but also how, you know, movies represent people. Like, you know, I mean, they've made so many movies about, you know, I don't know, like coal miners or, you know, these working class people where that is just the movie. It's, you don't need the Vietnam to show the other side of it.
Well, yeah. And that's actually honestly like what I was not necessarily to the extent of dreading, but like where I wasn't necessarily, you know, looking forward to my experience with this movie, because I just felt like there was no way that this movie could at all hold up, you know, after all these years. I was convinced that my affection for it was purely based on my, you know, pretentious, you know, movie snobism back when we were in film school. And, you know, it had been so long since I saw it that I just thought, you know, how is this movie supposed to hold up, especially in this day and age? Like, you know, not to get political, but where we have to, you know, hear about, you know, how these working class areas of America are so forgotten. And, you know, there's movies about that being made, like you said, Chapin. And, you know, then we get Vietnam, which is, you know, not irrelevant, for lack of a better term, with all the, you know, issues we have with wars that going on now. And I just felt like there was no way this movie was going to hold up the way I wanted it to. I tried to say that as politically correctly as I could. But it did. Like, and that's because, like what I said before, I think it has nothing to do with any of that. Like, I think it's the story beneath everything is so perfect. And the juxtaposition of how these characters change is universal. And I think it works purely on that level.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Chapin. Like, I do agree that if this movie was made today, it would maybe be a two-act movie. You know, how difficult, or just be about how difficult life is before they go off to war, and then
overcoming obstacles to succeed in the end.
And then how difficult life is, you know, once they get back, because nothing's really changed for them, because even though they went off and fought this war, we're still going back to this poor community. But this movie is not about that. This movie's about friendship. This movie's about relationships, and they enjoy their lives. Like you said, they enjoy their lives. There's nothing like it never judges them for anything they do, for their jobs, for their I guess relationships with each other and the women in their lives. It doesn't judge them for that. It just sort of shows it, and we can either sympathize or not sympathize, or go along with them or not go along with them. But it's not about their plot in life. It's about what got thrown at them, this hammer that came down on them, and then them dealing with it, coming back to that same situation and dealing with the ramifications of that hammer that hit them right in the head.
And it could have been anything. Like, you know, it could have been a death in the family, and like it could have, I think this story is universal in the sense on how you have a character and then something happens, and then how that something that happened changes that character.
Well, it's a little different than like one death in the family, because it affects...
No, it affects multiple people, but
a larger amount of the community.
No, but my point is on a simpler level. Like, take one character in this movie where one thing happens to them and how that one character changes as a result of it, and then just extrapolate that across all of the characters in this movie. I think that's right. What makes it universal. Is it? You know, it doesn't matter that it's Vietnam.
But
it doesn't matter.
I do think it matters that it's a war that they go to, because I do think that, like, what this movie does really well in that third act, like I mentioned before, is putting you or showing you the disconnect between these guys who have gone off and experienced
that's a good point,
thing.
Yeah.
And then the people that are back home, their family members, their loved ones, and the fact that there's really no matter what, there's no meshing those two worlds anymore. Because what do you say? How do you experience that or know what they went through? And again, it goes to Chapin's point, because I think without those Russian roulette scenes and without having something like that for the filmmakers to represent that sort of horror, then you don't get that third act. You don't get that those moments or understanding.
Well, moving on to our next segment, we will now be joined by our special surprise guest. Jeremy, could you do the honors, please?
Blockbuster Brantley's Mini Review! Review Mini Brantley!
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Modified over the years. Brantley is back.
Hi.
Yeah, this is very exciting, Brantley. It is great to have you back. So, it's been quite a while, obviously, for fans of the show. They know that Brantley was one of the original hosts, and we have him back to do one of his famous segments and also to help us with the top five.
Hey, yeah, Brantley, do you remember what your last podcast was?
I want to say, ever since I got contacted by Lee about coming and being a special guest on the 100th episode, I've been going back and listening to a number of the older episodes. I went back with much trepidation, I will say, to listen to them. And I want to say number 83, Prometheus, was my last one with you, Chapin.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I saw, too.
That makes sense. All right.
And that's, he didn't have an answer prepared, Brantley. He was just...
he
was actually trying to find out.
I really was just curious, yeah.
No, I looked the same thing up. It was Prometheus, and actually the one before that was also you and Chapin, and it was Men in Black 3, and I think that was probably where you decided, like, okay, I'll do one more, but then enough. Like, if we're going to keep seeing these these movies.
I think it was like The Dictator, Men in Black 3, and Prometheus, and the three-week period, and Brantley just had to get out.
That was it.
Yeah, I was like, hell with it.
Was I on the Dictator one? I don't remember that one.
It's a lost episode, but I think you are.
Yeah, that's the one we can't find.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember. I thought we had a pretty... I listened to that one again, and I think it was you, me, and Tyson.
Yep.
And I think we had a decent enough conversation about Prometheus. But I will say, yeah, when I went back to start listening to these, I was very worried that we've had some interesting times with this podcast 1 or 2 years ago, as Lee would say.
Absolutely.
Yes. And,
yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on, and I will say I'm one of your biggest fans. I know we have a few listeners, and I know some of them are also big fans, but I've really been enjoying listening to this 3.0 edition of Get Your Film Fix. I started and I was like, oh, I only want to listen to the ones where I've actually seen the movie. But then I just was like, no, I'm enjoying this too much. I'm just going to listen to them all, and I don't care if it ruins like aspects of it.
We'll kick it off with the Avengers, since that is obviously the biggest of blockbusters at the moment. And Chapin, you saw it as well. But Brantley, why don't we just start quickly with your thoughts on it?
Your thoughts on the whole Avengers Marvel universe and all the movies maybe leading up to it and the cultivation in that Avengers movie.
Sure. I guess I'll jump in with just some general ideas. I was not a big fan of Avengers Infinity War. And there's a number of reasons why. I'm sure we'll kind of discuss them more as we go along. But you know, the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's what is it, like 19, 20 movies now at this point, and you know, there's a number of issues I think that run within not just Marvel films but comic films in general. But when we used to talk about it on the podcast all the time, not just with comic movies but with other movies in general, and that was stakes, right? And the big issue with comic book movies is, you know, are there really ever any stakes? Because you never think that the comic book, the heroes are ever gonna not win the day, essentially. And I thought going into Avengers Infinity War that maybe finally there would actually be some real stakes with a villain like Thanos, and boy was I disappointed. Those are my general thoughts, and I can talk more certainly about it, but I don't know if you want to open it up to everybody else at this point.
So you lost me because you mentioned Thanos. Like, I mean, and that's how that's just me being out of touch.
Yes.
Right? No, I know, I got that, but you know, I think, you know, for it just kind of in response to that, like, I love the idea, and I said this a long time ago, I love the idea of creating this this universe over the, you know, created over 20 movies, and like, Iron Man just popping up for a scene in a Spider-Man movie or a Captain America movie, and like sort of these like, you know, crossing over of characters. And I think it's sort of brilliant, but I just feel like they've just done such a lazy job with it. And I think, you know, we had this discussion time after time after time about, because that was all they really needed to do to make $200 million in the first weekend or first couple weekends. And, you know, they were satisfied with that. But like that's what's always been so frustrating for me. And, you know, again, I haven't seen the new Avengers movie. I don't have a whole lot of interest in seeing it because I sort of just got tired of it.
Yeah, and I think though, even if you aren't getting tired of it, they're basically making you get tired of it, because the oversaturation of them and the amount of times they're coming out per year at this point is, I'm still shocked to see everyone get so excited about every new movie.
Yeah, they all do sort of, you know, have the same formula, which is something, you know, again, listening to some of the old episodes, you guys were really harping on Captain America: The First Avenger for, which I think at that point was like the fifth or sixth movie or something in this Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I agree, Lee, it is very cool that they have set up this world in which, you know, different characters pop into other characters' films, and there's always this overlap. And I think if there's one thing that the series has really done, it's this idea of world building and creating this world, especially like a New York or a Wakanda in Black Panther, that you feel is really connected to these other films in the series. But yeah, there's this overarching issue of just the formulaic nature of the comic book films in general that really, I don't think they've really gotten past in any way in most of these films.
Well, since you brought up Wakanda and Black Panther, because I did catch up with that, and something that I actually found really interesting about that movie that I wish was explored more, almost to the point where, like, I wish there was or could be a Black Panther miniseries, is that world of Wakanda and all these different tribes within it. I thought that was something amazing that could have been explored, and like why, you know, certain characters within certain tribes had certain motivations to either help the Black Panther or to help the Michael B. Jordan's character, or, you know, I thought that was a really interesting dynamic that was there but not really totally explored. It was just, you know, something in the middle of getting to the next fight scenes, which has just become so boring. Like, that was my first reaction leaving. I'm like, I want to learn more about all these tribes in Wakanda. And, like, so I think that, you know, that kind of speaks more to my interest in this world that they've created. Like, I wish they could explore that more, like, you know, and spend more time with that.
Yeah, and I also saw Black Panther. I thought it was interesting that they definitely tried to do something different with it. They almost tried to make it, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but they almost tried to make it a Bond movie.
I definitely noticed that.
Yeah, I felt like there was a lot of elements where it was basically, you know, you had the sister who was essentially Q, and you had
same thing. Yep.
Yeah, you had the casino, the car chase. Basically. Yeah, it just was like, okay, so they're like, this is interesting. This is an interesting idea. Let's take this Marvel, you know, concept and turn it into a Bond movie. But they only were able to do that to like a certain extent, and it all just kind of got pulled back into that Marvel universe in which we just knew it was going to happen. And like we talk about all the time, like Brantley just brought up, the stakes just weren't there. But I also thought Michael B. Jordan just wasn't very good, but I think I'm in the minority.
No, I totally agree, and I like him a lot. But
yeah, me too. I loved him in Creed.
I thought he was an afterthought for the main character.
That's interesting.
I think that's what I thought was so good about Black Panther was like they sort of built this mythology so well, right? Like they built all this, and I think that's what was so appealing to what you're saying, Lee. Like you wanted to learn more about all these tribes, and like they really created this world that was really cool. And so much so that like I kind of wish that Ryan Coogler had been available to work on been able to fill that spot of the director of the last star, or at least one of the last Star Wars movies, the one that Colin Trevorrow fell out of. So he'd be doing like the one that J.J. Abrams is now doing, but I guess the timing didn't work out, and you know they just love J.J. over there. But I actually liked Infinity War a lot, actually.
Oh, Okay.
Let's have this discussion. Opposing viewpoints.
Well, because
Brantley on the
wrong.
Opposite side of a comic
look,
book movie.
Here's what I'll say. Okay, so I will grant everybody that like the fight scenes are so lame. They're so uncreative, really, in a way. Like they're just the stakes are very low in terms of those, you know, it's just really just guys like throwing each other into things and like, how much of this can we watch? Right. And like, it's the same problem that kind of, I think Black Panther fell into, like by the end of that movie, it was sort of this formula, you know, this rather original vision and kind of new take on this comic book genre turned into, you know, just another battle. I mean, I think it was a little bit different, but like, you've just got, you know, these superheroes crashing into each other and, I'll give you that. Like that was a problem with Infinity War. But I disagree with Bradley. I think there were really high stakes, and without giving too much away, you know, we'll have to wait to figure out how real those stakes actually were. But you know, I think we lost some pretty important characters in that movie. And I think the one thing I would say is that I took away from this was that it really was. So it really was original in the sense that like it was the culmination of 19 movies, you know, like you had all these characters that were established. You had the sort of Thanos subplot that's been weaved through, I don't know, like 8 or 9 movies, and were less important in others. But, you know, and really when you got to this movie that was, you know, it's 149 minutes long. So it's still a huge movie. Was able to sort of efficiently tell this story because you knew these characters, you knew who they were. You didn't have to tell them you didn't have to tell the audience, you know, what Iron Man was doing or what Thor was doing. You had all that established. And so really, I think what was refreshing about the movie was that it could kind of just exist. It could kind of just be, you know, this story without all the buildup to it. That being said, I mean, it almost, in a weird way, it felt like it wasn't a movie. It was like I don't know. It was like something different.
A greatest hits album?
Almost in a way. I mean, it was like, there's still, you know, like I would say that like the main character in this is Thanos. And I think the way they executed Thanos, by the way, was like amazing. I remember sitting there at the end of the movie feeling like, you know, I don't have any, like, I am completely emotionally attached to this character as if it were a real person. I mean, it is, he's played by Josh Brolin, but it's done so convincingly, like even more so than I think like the Avatar, it was done in Avatar. Like you, this is like a real character with emotions, and he is like, I would wager he has the most screen time out of any character. And that's strange. Like, he's a completely CGI creation. But, yeah, like, it just didn't really have, like, an arc or a, you know, the sort of the things you think of when it has a standard story. It felt like, you know, I you know, as it is, it's the first piece of a longer movie. But, yeah.
No, so I have a question for you guys, for Chapin and Brantley, because you guys have both, I think, seen more, a lot more of these Marvel movies than me and Jeremy have, and it sort of speaks to the bigger question that I have about like how these continue to be and why they are so successful and such huge box office hits, and I guess maybe this is a little bit more for you, Chapin, because I know that we've had discussions and been harder on some of these movies than you know, perhaps some of the ones that we discussed, Brantley, back and some of the older podcasts. But like, what keeps you coming back to see these? Like, you know, even regardless of whether you liked Infinity War or not, like, you know, I think we can all agree that they've got to a point where they are intentionally formulaic, intentionally following the kind of guidelines to be a, you know, $200 million movie on opening weekend, with the minimal possible efforts. So, you know, is it that there's enough there to make you, if you're watching all of them, is there enough there to make you want to see what happens next, or what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm interested. I mean, to be completely honest, I haven't been a fan of all of them by any means. Even the more successful newer ones, like I didn't really like Doctor Strange, and everybody really liked the last Thor movie, but I wasn't crazy about that. You know, really, to be honest, like I was more interested in this as like from a production standpoint. Like, this is one of the biggest movies ever made, you know, like I wanted to see what this would look like. The pieces of it were seemed so extreme. Like you've got like 40 speaking roles and you've got like these, they're all these giant stars in it. And, you know, how are they going to pull this off? And I actually just surprisingly found myself being pulled into the story. I mean, I wouldn't say that I've like completely bought in on the larger narrative, Marvel narrative. I think there are tracks in it that I, that appeal to me more than others, like specifically the Captain America track, which is, you know, I think makes sense because the directors of the last two movies are now doing Infinity War. So I appreciate those guys and what they did. And I think when you drop the Russo brothers into this universe, it's a little strange because I think at least Captain America, in as much as you can be grounded in a series about, you know, like space travel and all that, is one of the more grounded, more realistic of the storylines here. And I think I like what the Russo brothers brought to this movie and to those movies, and I think it worked here in this world that is more in the kind of Guardians of the Galaxy world where you're dealing with aliens and like, you know, the main characters, you know, has purple skin, right? Like it's a little ridiculous, but these guys kind of bring what they brought to the Captain America series into this.
Yeah, I would agree too. I think it goes back to that building aspect of what the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe has been able to build up to this point. Which, you know, it's not like I could have, you know, skipped a couple of them and felt like I was out of place necessarily. But knowing that there's this long term plan that Marvel's building to with this Infinity War pieces. Yeah, it's really, I don't know if there's ever been kind of this massive of an undertaking in the film industry. I mean, this is a 10-year culmination, and it's not even done yet at this point. And it's kind of amazing to think that, you know, a studio would create, you know, 19, 20 films at this point that are all interconnected in some way, shape, or form, and have all, you know, fit together like a puzzle in a sense. They're all kind of attached to each other and can build up to one big finale, so to speak. And I know there's going to probably be more after Infinity War, the second one, but you know what I mean. And I would agree with a lot of what Chapin has said. I think Captain America is the most grounding force in the Marvel universe, and he's a character that I really connect to and appreciate, and is probably my favorite of the Marvel universe. And you know, everything that he's gone through is certainly not even from a, you know, like a superhero comic book fight sort of way, but just like the emotional turmoil that his character's gone through throughout this entire universe is really impressive. And I think has a little bit more delicacy than you see in a lot of comic book films.
Yeah. I mean, Lee, I here's the thing. I totally see what I understand your protest against like this kind of movie in general. There are too many of them, and the Marvel movies like have dominated the box office and sort of our collective consciousness, you know, in the last 10 years, and their success has like only fueled that more. But like really, I think that they've done a lot. Like the Paul, what's his name? Kevin Feige, the kind of the creative director of the whole thing, the guy who produces all of them, really has cast like really good people in. Like you said, Brantley, like you wouldn't think it, but Chris Evans is quite good, I think, as Steve Rogers, and they've got really good actors, and they've hired really good directors and people who have creative visions. And yeah, I mean, like it's not going to be, you know, PTA movies, and we could make an argument about like, you know, is this the right place to put resources in movies? And I would kind of fall down on, I wish, you know, movies like Phantom Thread and the things we've talked about in the past couple podcasts weren't as hard to get made as, you know, with all this money being spent on a movie like The Avengers. But, you know, once you surrender to it, I think, you know, they can be fun.
I guess my frustration is not so much why aren't these movies a PTA movie as much as like, why can't they be Lord of the Rings? You know, that's I guess the closest comparison as far as an undertaking that I can think of, you know, and perhaps, you know, the source material is, I don't even know if the source material is different, because like I said, with Black Panther, like there's clearly a, you know, a world and a history with that war, that Wakandu, that is, you know, extraordinarily detailed and interesting. So I think it's so frustrating because everything you guys said makes sense, and it's just it's done so haphazardly, it feels like, and it's just done so quickly, and just to how quickly can we get the next $1 billion movie?
Yeah, I agree too. I agree with you, Lee, but I think a lot of it, like you mentioned, Lord of the Rings, and I think, like, for that, what worked so well was you had this narrative and these characters that you could follow really easily down a path. But with these Marvel movies, you're sort of spread out a little bit, and it's harder to grasp onto one thing. And I guess I can see the appeal of seeing all these movies, and especially with Avengers Infinity War, bringing them all together. If you did take the time to watch all of them, and then there's this sort of culmination of them, I can see how that can be satisfying, and I can see how that could work. And I'm kind of torn too, because you guys make a lot of good points on both sides, and it's like, yeah, money, if there's going to be money that's going to be spent, it should be spent on movies like this. I've always argued that directors like PTA and Scorsese and Tarantino, if they get too much money, then their movies suffer, because for them, there's some creativity behind not having them. But for this, it's like, yeah, it's the special effects, and it's, you know, the amount of money you're putting into the cast and the costumes and makeup and all that stuff, whatever. But yeah, I guess there's just a disconnect somewhere that's not pulling you in, like for example, Lord of the Rings pulls you in, or Game of Thrones pulls you in with their character development. And because when, you know, if you watch Game of Thrones and somebody and there's a battle or a fight or something, you're invested in those characters and you care. With some of these movies, it's like, all right, well, he'll throw a car on that person, and you know that building will blow up, and then eventually we're really back to the start. So, I mean, I think that's sort of the difference there.
This week on our special 100th episode, we are doing our top five of the 2010 decade. We started with our top five ever, and I revised it because I thought that was a little too much to take on right now and a little too much. And so I think this is a little bit better. So, anybody have any criteria they want to mention? I guess it's just, I guess I just went over it.
Yeah.
Let's start with. Go ahead, Randy. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just gonna say the only criteria I put in was that I didn't have any films from 2017, and I think that was just my own way of self-imposing, trying to take out any recency bias. Because I did try to watch all of these films again before that I have on my list before, just to make sure that I didn't just misremember a film the first time I watched it and rewatched it and thought, what the hell am I thinking? I don't know if you guys did anything like that, but I kind of didn't have anything from 2017.
I feel very ashamed. Brantley prepared for this podcast way better than I have prepared for any podcast.
Chapin actually hasn't seen half the movies.
I just googled it.
It's the last five Oscar winners.
Yeah. Okay, well, on that note, Brantley, why don't you go kick us off with our number five? Your number five.
Okay, I would love to. So I definitely attacked this list, by the way, by my favorites. I texted Lee and I was like, trying to confirm that it is favorites, not what we think are the best films of the decade. And, I think you can go by favorites in a number of different ways. You know, is it something that you feel like you could watch over and over again? Is it something that just has an emotional connection to you for whatever reason? But my number five, maybe a little obvious, but it's Drive from 2011. I think Drive was everything I wanted it to be when I went in and saw it, especially having read the book a few years beforehand. Because reading the book, I had this experience of, oh, this is a movie. I'm reading a book, but this feels like a movie to me. And I thought Nicholas Winding Refn and Ryan Gosling did a phenomenal job bringing that to screen, and Refn bringing his own style. And I will say, gratuitous and over-the-top violence. I don't know why I got into such a debate with Jeremy listening back to some of the podcasts we talked about it, because it is certainly gratuitous and over-the-top.
Well, I think that's a really good pick. That movie definitely grew. I don't remember if I was even on the Drive podcast, but I remember I don't think I liked it as much when I first saw it, but I'm a big fan of it now. I think it's a beautifully shot movie.
I'm the exact same way, Chapin. I recently rewatched it too, and I really liked it.
Beautiful. Okay, right. Well, Lee, let's move on to your number five, please.
Okay, my number five.
Wait,
so
did you have any criteria?
No. I didn't. I actually
didn't even have to be from 2010 on.
I just went with any movies that I like.
Citizen Kane,
Casablanca.
This was hard to do. I mean, like, so the previous decade, the 2000s, at least me, Jeremy, and Brantley put together our top. Actually, I don't remember if Brantley did, but me and Jeremy put together our top 25s of that decade. It was kind of one of the first. I think that was maybe was pre Get Your Film Fix. You know, that was 25 movies, and I remember, you know, kind of scouring what I'd seen and putting that together, and it being kind of a fun thing to do. And now to narrow this down to five was difficult, and I was actually surprised going through everything and seeing how many of, you know, what I would consider great movies of the past decade I have seen. So I was happy about that. But my number five, I did recently rewatch, and while it didn't nearly have the same impact as it did when I first saw it, I think I'm giving it some credit for the impact it had originally, and that's Boyhood. Richard Linklater's project, 12-year project. That was a movie that I absolutely fell in love with when I first saw it. And when we started talking about doing this, I thought it, you know, that was a potential number one. But having seen it recently, like some of the flaws in the dialogue and the acting and the storytelling being a little bit too much on the nose bothered me more this time around. I can't forget about how much that movie impacted me and how much I loved it when I first saw it. So that's going to be my number five.
Great.
Beautiful.
So the only criteria I did have, and this actually became an issue on two of mine that will end up being honorable mentions because they didn't make it, was I went with the IMDb release of the movie, because there's two of these movies that were right around 2009, 2010, yeah, depending on whether
on your list. I think I know what you're talking about.
Well, it's not. It ended up being 2009 IMDb, so I kept both of those movies off. Although they would have, one of them would have been really high, but it'll be an honorable mention. But the rest of these were just my favorites and how I responded to them, and some I've revisited, some I haven't. Maybe they would change if I did. That being said, my number five is a movie called Sing Street.
Interesting.
It came out in 2016. It's sort of a musical by the same guy who did Once. And it just was something that kind of I fell for, and I enjoyed, and I enjoyed the characters, and I felt something for it. And I've seen it maybe two times since. It's like one of those movies where I just really enjoy kind of putting it on, and as Brantley would call it, it could be a laundry show. But I enjoyed it tremendously, and it's my number five.
Have you seen his new movie? I'm forgetting what it's called, with Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley.
No, that's an older movie. This is that's his newest movie.
Yeah, I think that was called
Sing Street.
Begin
came
Again.
After Begin Again, yeah. So, oh, that came before Sing Street.
Yeah, that was like three years before.
Oh,
it's John Carney's.
Yeah, John Carney. Because that one I didn't like. I love Once, and I liked Sing Street a lot. But
yeah, Sing Street was excellent. That was a great pick. Great pick, Jeremy.
Okay, yeah. So I had the same sort of thoughts that you guys did on this list. I have like a ton of honorable mentions, and I have to say that I didn't want to be too ashamed of this list, and so like there are movies on here that I think I enjoyed watching, that I really haven't had I didn't take the time Brantley did to really compare them, and so I wish that I had. But I'll go through my honorable mentions at the right time. But I just, as an example, like I had to leave off Gravity, which is a movie that I love. I probably enjoyed that experience the first time I saw it more than anything, but I couldn't put it, for some reason, I just couldn't have it that high on the list. But that being said, my number five is a tie, so I hope that's okay. And the number five spot goes to The Master, and I tie that with The Tree of Life, which is a movie I recently revisited. I know it's a controversial pick, especially among this group, but I felt so much for it. It's a flawed film, but I just felt so much while watching that movie in the middle of the day on, you know, Blu-ray at my old house. And, like, I don't know, something about it, it moved me so much that I couldn't leave it off. And it made my list a little bit more prestigious.
So why a tie between those two? What's the connection?
Oh, I'm curious too.
I just think that
you just needed to put them both on.
I just needed to have them both on.
Because you needed a top six.
Because the rest of my list is a little embarrassing. No, I think that those movies do actually have some similarities. I think they're obviously very different, but they just kind of landed at the same spot. I wanted to get The Master on the list. So I just couldn't. The reality of the rest of these movies, I just like them more. I think The Master is also a flawed film that probably could have been one of the best movies of all time, and I think there are some flaws with it which we may or may not have skirted around in past episodes. And so I think they both are flawed films, but there's so much brilliance in it at parts of it that I had to get them on there.
So my number four, this is the film that I just find the most fun, the most enjoyable. It is one that I can rewatch over and over again and have a number of times. And it's What We Do in the Shadows by Taika Waititi, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I really want to see that.
I've seen it. It's funny. It's a funny movie.
It is. And, you know, I guess if you're tired of the mockumentary style, you know, whether it's from The Office or Parks and Rec or any of the other movies that have done it, I can understand how you
might find Tomorrow.
I can understand how you might find it, tiresome or not up your alley. But for me, I find it to be just the most effortlessly funny film of this decade so far, and that's why it made my list.
My number four. So this is a movie that I've only seen once. I'd be curious how I felt upon revisiting it, but it is Moonlight, Best Picture winner of 2016.
Wow.
I loved this movie. I think it's, you know, it's a movie obviously that is relevant and topical, and I think to a certain extent important. And I like when movies have those qualities but are also good. You know, I think so often movies get a sort of false credit, for lack of a better term, for being topical and relevant. I think you guys would make that argument perhaps for Three Billboards. And you know, this movie I thought worked on so many levels. I thought it had some of the best scenes that I've seen in the past decade. One of the final scenes with Mashahara Ali, I think is, I don't know if that's how you say his name, specifically when the little boy asks him if he sells drugs to his mom and he doesn't know how to answer the question, I thought was so powerful. And I just think that was a fantastic movie. I think, you know, for an audience member that doesn't have any way, shape, or form an ability to relate to that character, I was able to relate to him, and I think I was super happy it won Best Picture over La La Land, that almost did. And you know, again, until I see it again, it sticks there as one of my favorites of the decade.
I think that's a great point, Lee. I think you brought up exactly what I was going to say about it, is that it's got that universality to it. Very few people understand what it's like to grow up, you know, being gay and being poor and being black, and yet it's a movie that
Man, you bring this up every time. Grew up poor and gay and black.
You still feel for it. Like, it's still such a universal story somehow. All right.
Absolutely. This was a real serious honorable mention for me, and I almost had it on my list, so I'm glad it showed up on yours, Lee.
Yeah, these have been good picks so far, so I'm going to go ahead and start ruining this. because I, when I was doing the research for this, I felt like two things stood out from this decade so far as great movies go. And the two things are sort of sci-fi space movies and Leonardo DiCaprio. So that being said, my number four is Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant.
God damn you. Fuck.
One of those movies that I had such high hopes for going into, And because usually when I have such high hopes going into a movie, I know that I'm not going to like it as much. So I knew that going into the movie, but it totally lived up to all the expectation. And I've seen it again since. And I think it's brilliant. I think everything about this movie works. Yeah.
Good pick.
Very good. Fuck. That is also my number four.
Oh, okay.
I had a feeling that was going to be on the list multiple times.
Yeah, it was another very serious consideration on mine, but I just didn't make the cut for me. But my number three is, I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's Don't Think Twice by Mike Birbiglia. He'd previously done Sleepwalk with me, but Don't Think Twice is about improv comedy actors in New York, and basically what happens when one of them starts to get success and the others don't. And it's just a great character study of, you know, people who dedicate their lives to a craft that they know has to end at some point. And it's just like a real kind of love letter to the creative spirit, so to speak, in a similar way that something like Brigsby Bear was this past year. And it's one that I've watched probably like three times now at this point. I just I love the characters, and I love the way that they're kind of dynamic shifts and implodes and changes as they go through the struggles together. So that's my number three.
I've seen that movie, Brantley, and I agree. It's really good. It's really interesting to watch these characters in that specific a job try to get through life, basically in a totally different way than most people have to get through life.
Mm-hmm.
And relate to each other. How they have to relate to each other, being comedians and you know, standing up on stage with each other, is so different than normal people, and it's really interesting to watch that dynamic and watch these people go through it. And I agree, that was a really good movie. Good pick.
Thanks.
All right, so the frustrating thing about a list like this is you can't like pull an honorable mention and like replace stuff, I guess. So my number three has been mentioned. It is The Revenant. Jeremy, I'm glad you've seen it again. But the interesting thing is, I've only seen it once, but The Revenant is not one of those movies where you feel like you need that affirmation upon second viewing. Like that's a movie that sticks with you. Like, when you leave the theater, you know it's good, and you're always going to know it's good.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about it, it's not like Schindler's List or something where you're like, oh, or Tree of Life, or something that you're like, I know that was good, but like, I don't really particularly want to see it again.
No way. It's
the cinematography alone is worth just checking. Like, you just want to like,
yeah, no,
view all these landscapes and everything, the way it was filmed, and it was just,
yeah. I couldn't rewatch it before this, but I watched the trailer two or three times. Like, honestly, like it's one of those movies that just is from start to finish, and every aspect of it is like awe-inspiring. Like, yeah. It's just so well done. Like, it's just such a beautiful movie to look at. The story is so engaging. The stakes are like unreal. So it's a great movie. Yeah, it's my number three.
It's uncompromising, I would say. They, you know, no, nothing was easy about making that movie, and you can tell.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. All right. So, continuing with my theme, my number three is Wolf of Wall Street. You know, also another theme, in addition to Leo and space sci-fi movies, is great directors. They're still here. They're still, you know, the people we're talking about, The Revenant, we're talking about Scorsese here, Wolf of Wall Street, Linklater with Boyhood Lee. I mean, you have somebody behind the helm that knows what they're doing, and they create this unforgettable piece of art that you just want to keep watching over and over. And Wolf of Wall Street's one of those few ones I have watched over and over and over again, because it's simultaneously funny in a way that you know is horrible, but you're still laughing. And it's great filmmaking. It's Scorsese doing Scorsese. It's Scorsese doing Goodfellas on Wall Street. It's you know, it's everything you want it to be.
Yeah, it's probably the most, you know, to use this term. It's probably the most Scorsese movie that we've seen in a long time, even more so than The Departed, which I love. Like, you know, The Departed has elements of, you know, what he does well, but like that, you know, the pacing and the tone of Wolf of Wall Street is, you know, so much like, you know, that of Mean Streets and things that we remember from, you know, his early years.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else there is to say about that movie at this point. Chapin, what do you got?
My number three is Inception.
Wow. Leo. Cue again, Hans Zimmer.
That fits into the great directors and the Leonardo DiCaprio theme.
This one was just undeniable for me. I mean, this is the one I've watched the most on the list. It's just you can. It was a revelation when it came out to me. I couldn't believe, you know, he made this between Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises, and he just leveraged all his success to make this, you know, rather original but, you know, enormously expensive, you know, epic movie. And it was the first movie you guys reviewed on the podcast, and I think it stands
episode
at now.
One.
Yep, and so.
It was like the inception of the podcast.
Honestly, what the biggest compliment I can give to that is my response to Jeremy's question on that podcast, where I mean, we were like borderline suicidally obsessed with the trailer of that movie. We watched that, you know, more times than you can count. And Jeremy's question was, did it live up to the trailer? Did it meet our expectations? And my answer was yes. Like, I don't know if you can give it a bigger compliment than that if you kind of know how we, you know, behaved after we watched that trailer.
it's insufferable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great pick. My number two is Hell or High Water. Starring Chris Pine and Ben Foster. Ooh. And Jeff Bridges. It's a modern Western, but it's really just this great exploration of class in America. And it's all these different, you know, juxtapositions, you know, urban versus rural and low class versus, you know, middle or high class, you know, and business versus the individual, you know, with the banks trying to take over the land. And there's also this juxtaposition, too, between, you know, what's essentially happening to lower and lower middle class white people in that area and, you know, what happened to the Native Americans by the, you know, ancestors of those white people 150, 200 years beforehand. I thought it was just this great film of, you know, duality, so to speak. And I loved it. I thought it was phenomenal.
Yeah, and they needed an older guy with wearing a cowboy hat, so they had to put Jeff Bridges in it.
Yes.
I like that movie a lot. I think it's sort of an unfortunately forgettable, not forgettable by my standards, but like forgettable in the grand scheme of things. I feel like it's gotten a bit lost, but yeah, sure. I liked that movie a lot. All right, my number two, perhaps a little bit in the sticking with the theme of this episode, revisiting, you know, an old segment of ours in documentaries are movies too. My number two is OJ, Made in America.
Oh my
great
God.
Great pick. I thought about that, but that's a great pick.
Ezra Edelman's five-part, absolutely stunningly engaging series on OJ Simpson trial.
Fuck.
Like, I've watched that multiple times. So it's like 15 hours long or something.
Me too. I think I've watched
like,
it. Many
I've watched
times.
It
go
multiple
go
times.
How do we watch this again? Is it on Netflix? I want to watch it right now.
You got to watch it on like ESPN Go or something. But yeah, and I've since read two books on the O.J. Simpson trial. Like, and that's what
watch
a documentary.
The FX series.
That's in the FX series, which is as flawed as it is interesting. And this is what a documentary should do.
It's
like,
so,
it should
so
make you
better.
Want to
it's
learn
like,
more.
It's so much more dramatic. The documentary, like the stuff that.
Oh, no, it's not
so,
even comparison.
Like,
yeah.
They capture that, the tragedy of him. Like, it's so brilliant. It's, I can't believe it.
Yeah, that's a great pick, and it's an honorable mention for me. I think the problem was I only saw the first three, and I felt like I couldn't put it on there because I hadn't found a place to watch the last
episode
two,
four
but,
is probably the most impressive one too.
But it is amazing. It's a great documentary.
Okay, Jeremy, you're number two? Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll get to my boring list, but it, you know, there's just some things you have to put on here, and it's literally going to be Brantley's prediction list.
Yeah.
But my number two is The Social Network. Yeah. So you got an amazing director working at the top of his game with a great writer, telling a quintessential 1990s story. I mean, it just like the age of the internet, the coming of the internet. I mean, it really worked for me.
That is also my number two.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to transition because it was perhaps my most predictable pick as well. It's my number one film of the decade is The Social Network. It's probably not my favorite Fincher film, but I think this is the film where he's maybe at like the pinnacle of his filmmaking abilities, and I don't know if you guys necessarily agree with that, but I think he's just does such a great job.
It's up there.
Yeah,
he's taking a story that's mostly dialogue,
mm-hmm,
and
exactly.
Honestly, maybe on the surface, relatively uninteresting, and yep, taking it and turning it into something that's generational.
Exactly. I think you just put it much better than I was about to. So yes, words right out of my mouth. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yep. How I feel about it.
Social Network is my number one of the decade. Look, I think it's Fincher's masterpiece, and I'm not sure that he will top it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to, you know, probably likely at some point do a Fincher retrospective, so I don't want to reveal too much, but I did recently rewatch Benjamin Button, and I wanted to fucking blow my brains out.
So bad.
It's so disappointing. So
how that is the same director as The Social Network is beyond me. Like, I've seen Social Network several times. I've watched it relatively recently, and it is so masterfully done. Like, mm-hmm, and we, you know, we went at it at nauseam on the podcast on how well Fincher captured Sorkin's dialogue and how Sorkin told the story and how it was such a perfect pairing, and that's all true. But I mean, this is a movie about something that, you know, speaks, you know, 100% to our generation. That can't be denied, so perhaps that plays a factor. But it is such a fun movie to watch at the simplest level. Like, the characters are interesting. It's fun to watch. Like, Justin Timberlake, he's sort of like this, like, caricature of, like, who we all sort of want to be in a certain sense. And, like, that's, you know, and that's an aspect that we forget about because everything is based on a true story. And you know, the amazing scenes of, you know, Mark when he's running and throwing down his laptop, like everything about that movie just is so good. And I don't know how it's you and Jeremy's number two, Chapin. I can't wait to hear your number ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Actually, I'm convinced that it probably should have been my number one, but I went with my heart and my gut on number one, and maybe on a revisit, like you'd mentioned earlier, Lee, it's not going to be there, but it is right now Richard Linklater's Boyhood.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought it would be my number one, but, you know.
To me, it just hit, I think maybe also being a guy growing up as a boy, there was something that just hit you about that movie.
Glad you specified that.
Well, I mean, you never know. Growing up as a woman and now a man. Yeah, there's just something that you either respond to or you don't respond to on an emotional level, and I totally responded to it, and yeah, that made it my number one of the decade so far.
Wow. Okay. Well, yeah, my number one was not on any of your guys' lists, and maybe it won't be on any of your honorable mentions either. But my number one is Mad Max: Fury Road.
Ooh, I thought it's an honorable mention for me for sure.
Yep, same here.
That was a close. Revenant was my favorite movie of that year, so like I couldn't put it ahead of that.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I very, very seriously considered putting it, because I was tweaking my list here and there and just kind of shuffling things around, and it very, very nearly made my list, so I'm glad it's there on yours, but also number one on yours. I didn't realize you enjoyed it so much.
It's an amazing movie. Like,
it's, yeah.
It's so well done.
It's the Cirque du Soleil of movies.
You never got a higher praise than that. Well, here's some of my honorable mentions. I think it's interesting. If you go back and listen to the podcast, the comparison you guys started it, and then we continued ruining 2011 versus 2010. And so it wasn't surprising that for Jeremy, me, and Lee, our number one movie, Moneyball, did not make an appearance on any of these lists.
So I had four honorable mentions, and I was as hard on 2011 as anybody, but Django, that was 2011, right?
No, that was 2012.
No, that was 12. But okay. But then Moneyball, The Artist,
I'm surprised
and
it didn't make your list.
So Django is my number six. But Moneyball, The Artist, and Melancholia were kind of my top honorable mentions, all from 2011.
So The Artist.
So basically,
I loved The Artist, and I saw it again recently, and it holds up. It's great.
It's a good movie. But let's go back to Django. So basically, you're saying that if Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs came out this decade, they wouldn't be on this list.
Wait, why? How do you get that?
Because
how do you get that?
Because Django was your number one Tarantino movie.
Well, yeah, but that's making
these lists are flawed.
So you're saying, what are my top five of the '90s? Is Pulp Fiction on that list?
Yeah, well, I would assume that it would make that list.
So perhaps the 2010s are a better decade.
No, first of all, no, they're not. And then second of all, Pulp Fiction wouldn't be on this list of 2010.
Fuck, like, I don't
Revenant,
know. Jesus.
Yeah. Revenant would be ahead of Pulp Fiction.
It goes Pulp Fiction, The Artist.
The Artist. All right. Well, Brantley, we have to thank you so much for joining us. And well, I hope it's not the last time.
Oh, God.
I don't think it will be.
Thank you guys so much for having me back on. This is a really fun blast from the past. And yeah, anytime you want me on, let me know. I'd be more than happy to come on and relive one or two years ago.
Yeah, Chapin hasn't really been pulling his weight, so we'll probably call you soon.
Yeah, because he took all Brantley.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.